Welcome back to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, the film and TV makers, all those producers and directors and writers and actors and cinematographers, the production designers, set decorators even, costume designers, VFX gurus, sound mixers, sound editors, film editors, authors, composers, you name it, we talk to everyone. And hey, if you want to listen to a lot of talking, go to behindthelensonline.net and you can hear all of my For Your Consideration Emmy Award interviews with potential nominees for Palme Royale. Those are all up now. Todd McMullen, the cinematographer, Alex Friedberg, costume designer. And if you've watched Palme Royale, you know how delicious and divine those costumes are. John Carlos and Ellen Reed, the production designer and set decorator. And Jeff Toyne, the composer. And you got to admit, the music in Palme Royale is fantastic. With such a blend of genres, plus some great period-perfect 1969 needle drops. If you haven't seen Palme Royale, all 10 episodes are streaming on Apple TV+. See it. And especially, you know, Kristen Wiig is fantastic, but the real gem is Carol Burnett in terms of performance. And I'm so happy that it was just announced on Thursday, we're getting a season two of Palme Royale. So yay. But if you want to hear any of those masterful artisans talk about their work on Palme Royale, just go to behindthelensonline.net. The interviews are there, as are interviews for those fantastic craftsmen of Masters of the Air. I've got two more that are going up tonight. You heard stunt coordinator Lee Morrison, my interview with Lee right here on the show. Already out are my interviews with the sound crew from Formosa, who did Masters of the Air. And gee, thanks Formosa. I saw the really cool thing that you did with the interview I posted. So that was really great, guys. Thank you. But I have long said it. I maintain it. Formosa Group, when you need sound, Formosa Group is the absolute best. And that interview for your Emmy consideration, folks, is out there. And there's going to be a couple more coming on Masters. And then another plethora of interviews coming out later this week. But for right now, on Behind the Lens today, a fun show. This is a fun show. First of all, joining us at the midpoint of the show, Jonathan Smith is back. Many of our regular listeners, you're going to remember Jonathan was on the show, I think it was in 2019, with his film Batshit Bride. Funny. So he's been off working, obviously, and working on another film, because he joins us today to talk about his new film called Guy Friends. Ladies out there, you're going to love this film. It is so funny. One of the great, interesting things about the film, the lead actress in the film, she is, I believe, a nurse by trade. She's never acted before in her life, and she is wonderful. The film is shot in black and white. It has some moments that pop up in color, but the film itself, it is black and white. It looks beautiful. And Jonathan, not only is he writer, director, editor, and cinematographer on the film, and he did some sound mixing too. So Jonathan really understands how you make a film and all the different departments and all the tools in the toolbox that go together to make a film. So I'm very excited to have Jonathan back with us at the midpoint of the show. But first, I got to tell you, This film popped up during Academy Awards season in the fall, late in the fall. Robot Dreams, animated film. It was the Academy Award nominee for Best Animated Feature at the Academy Awards this year. Unfortunately, Robot Dreams lost to Miyazaki's The Boy and the Heron, also an excellent film. For my money, though, I think Robot Dreams should have won. I'm a huge, huge admirer of the writer-director Pablo Berger. I fell in love with his work, it's been 12, 13 years ago, with this stunning fable, Blancanieves, black and white, and it was a meld of fairy tales, fables, just so beautiful. And by the way, my review for Blancanieves is up on my website, if you want to check it out, and on Rotten Tomatoes, and on IMDb. And he's done several films since Blancanieves, including Abracadabra, which is also wonderful. But now Pablo ventured into animation. He's the first one to admit he's not an animator. He's not an artist. He cannot draw. He does not draw. But he delivers this incredible animated film, Robot Dreams, based on Sarah Varone's kids' book, picture book of the same name. Varone's book, there are no words. It's just pictures. And one of the great things about picture books is that when you're a kid, it lets your mom, you imagine the story. You imagine what you're seeing in the pictures as they unfold. It's almost like a Harold and the Purple Crayon, where Harold draws from page to page his purple crayon, and then he draws a boat, and then you see him, you know, imagining himself on a boat and going through all these adventures. And this is really what the book, the kids' book, Robot Dreams, that is very similar to what we see unfold, as this is the story of Dog. Dog lives in Manhattan, but he's alone, and he keeps seeing everybody down on the street, and as he looks out of his apartment window, he realizes he's missing something. He's tired of being alone. So one day he decides he's going to build himself a robot as a companion. And he does. He builds. And Robot and Dog become not only the best of friends, but they become inseparable. And this story unfolds to 1980s New York City in the summer. All of the neighborhoods, the sounds, the music, the melding of, it's a real melting pot in this neighborhood where Dog and Robot live. But then something happens, and Dog must abandon Robot at the beach. Something has happened. Robot can't move, and he's too heavy. Dog can't move him. So he figures he'll come back with his toolbox, but it was the last day of summer, and he couldn't get in. So what happens? What happens to Robot? What happens to Dog? And this plays out through the seasons, the different seasons, the fall, the winter, the spring. It is beautiful. There are moments that are heartbreaking. I'll tell you right now, the hour 15 mark, you need tissues. You need a box of tissues. At the hour 15 mark, it will break your heart. But then, as you'll hear me in my interview with Pablo, I told him, I said, but then he puts all the pieces of your heart back together again. This film, it is masterful and magical. It did a very limited run for Academy consideration back in the late fall, early winter of award season. It is now being released. So that it's actually, it opened on May 31st in theaters only. I'm hoping it's going to move into DVD, Blu-ray, streaming, so that even more people can see it. This is truly, it's a sparkling animated gem. It's a ebullient, effervescent. There's a purity and an honesty to it. The simplicity of the drawings, the use of color, the vibrancy that we get from the city itself is spectacular. And then, of course, the songs that Pablo picked out. We've got the incredible September, Do You Remember? Or Earth, Wind, and Fire. And then we've got I'm So Happy. And these films and these songs really bookend and are part of the heartbeat of the film. I can't recommend this highly enough. It truly is. It was my pick last year or earlier this year for the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature. As much as I love Miyazaki's work, now, Robot Dreams, creative, imaginative, inventive, an incredible adaptation of a children's picture book into a film for adults and children alike. So I was so thrilled when I got to speak with Pablo again, as it has been about 12 years, and we had limited time. We only had about 15 minutes, but we covered a lot, talking about Robot Dreams, what led him to it, how he interpreted it visually. So instead of listening to me prattle on, listen to my exclusive interview with writer-director Pablo Berger talking about the magical Robot Dreams. Hi, Pablo.
Hi, Debbie. Where are you? I don't see you.
No, because I'm calling in on a phone. I'm old school.
Okay.
I like the simplicity. Just like this.
I like that. I'm old school. I'm old analogical, too.
Uh-huh. So one thing that isn't old school, but that embraces everything old school that is so dear, is Robot Dreams. Pablo, this film, it is masterful. It is magical. It is sparkling. I am so in love with this film. The animation, it is simple, but it's very deep focus. It draws you in. You have the animators focusing on the eyes of our characters. The eyes are the windows to the soul. And that's exactly what we get watching this film. We feel the emotion, the pain, the joy, the sorrow of dog, of robot, of duck. On every level, this is pure magic. As much as I loved Blancanieves, I love this one even more.
Debbie, you said so many amazing, beautiful, generous things about my work and my dear Robot Dreams, you know. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I made it for you, Debbie. You know, your reaction is exactly what I was dreaming of. Audience reacted like you.
Now, something that I love that you have done is, I know when I was very young, I loved picture books with no words because I could make up the story myself based on the illustrations, based on the pictures. And I love how you have taken Sarah's book that has no words and it's a picture book, and you have created this very textured world that really comes from the imagination by incorporating, you know, New York, which is its own character in this film. What was it that led you to choose Sarah's book with no words and turn it into an animated film, especially when you are not an animator?
You're right. You know, I like to take risks as a director, if you know my previous film. The thing is that the origin all has to go with 2010, when I got the graphic novel of the same name, Robot Dream, because I collect graphic novels without dialogue and picture books without dialogue. I collect them. So I just got it. I loved it, but I put it on the shelf with the other graphic novels. I had to make Blancanieves and Abracadabra, two live-action films. And when I read it again in 2018, 8 years later, when I got to the end of the book, I was so moved. But I'm talking about deeply moved. I was like in tears. And I said, wow, this story resonates in me now in a very different way. I had lost my best friend. I had lost my mother. I thought about relations that I had in the past. And I said, I want to talk about the theme of relationships and friendship and the fragility of relationships and the power of memory. And that's the only reason I made this movie. Mm. And that's why I made it as an adaptation and into animation, because as I said before, not even once in my life I thought I was going to make an animated film. But I love so much the story and the characters.
It's exquisite. The characters, they're simple, and it's very relatable. Little kids can watch this film. Adults can watch this film. And everybody can relate to these characters on some level, and particularly the friendships that we see. And as you said, the power of memory, and how sometimes you keep the memories, but you can move on with them into new friendships. And we see that play out so beautifully. And I'm crying. At the hour 15 mark, you had me in tears. In tears at that junkyard. You broke my heart there. But you put the pieces back together for me with Rascal, the introduction of Rascal. So I forgive you for breaking my heart, because then you mended it.
I made it for you, this film, Debbie, honestly. You know, I have a certain age, and I'm sure you also have experience in your life, you know, and so many times they have broken up to pieces, but Rascal comes to the rescue. I think we all had our Rascal, or sometimes we've been Rascal to somebody else. So the characters of Robot Dreams, in a way, they're representations, they're metaphors, they're icons. And I love the idea that the audience makes substitutions, and they make the film their own, and they can use their own memories to complete the film.
Now, something else you have done incorporated here that doesn't surprise me, because you do love film and you love classic film of days gone by. I mean, that was evident with Blanca Nieves and what you did there.
Yes,
I gotta tell you, I was overjoyed to see your dance. Not only are you pay homage to Gone with the Wind and some film classics, but you pay tribute to Busby Berkeley with the Dancing Poppies.
Yeah,
that,
you're right.
Oh my God, Pablo, brilliant, brilliant. That entire sequence. How important was it that the animators get that sequence right? Because you incorporated all the geometric movements that Berkeley was known for, the overhead camera shots. Not easy to do.
Well, that was a very difficult scene, and one of my most favorite one. Of course, I love Busby Berkeley, you know, and of course I like all the surreal part of it, and all those symmetrical and all these unique kind of dance routines and choreography. That was a tough, and I wanted to combine it with the Wizard of Oz as well, because as you said, the film is full of film references. And I like that idea. Before a director, I'm a film audience, and I love that the film is full of Easter eggs for people like you, that you find references to films and to different films that you love. But I must say, that was a lot of hard work to get it right, you know, the Busby Berkeley scene, you know. And for me, it's probably my favorite dream of the film.
Just absolutely exquisite. And yes, I would have to say it's my favorite scene of the film as well, that whole sequence and the tribute to film, as we have Robot step out of a screen and spin the set around and be transported. Just absolute, it's divine. Now, the sound and the music is so important here. Your needle drops, Earth, Wind, and Fire, Do You Remember? It's just perfect, perfect. And of course, the third act, Robot Song, the I'm So Happy song, that's perfect too. It's a beautiful bookend for the film. But the sound itself, because there is no dialogue, we really rely on the ambience of New York and what we're seeing. And there is so much depth to this soundscape and the sound design. It's true sensory immersion. what were your thoughts on the sound design and the incorporation of music along with score, Alfonso de Villalonga's score? What was that like? What were you looking for there?
Well, I'm happy that we are addressing about the sound, because some people, they say, oh, Robert Grimm is a silent film.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not a silent film. It's a dialogue-free film, but there's an extremely complex sound design. It's the most complex sound design I ever done in all my films. I worked with Fabio Lardoglio, the sound designer of my last film, Abracadabra, before Robot Dreams, and she had a team with six people working for a year. You know, we know New York has backgrounds and streets and avenues and different neighborhoods, but New York is also distinct for the sound. You know, it's a loud city, it's noise. And of course, we have to have alarms and from the fire department, from the police, from the... But they have to be alarmed from the period, because this film takes place in the 80s. Now they have completely different alarms, so we have to do all that research. And of course, New York is the jungle of music, of different types of music, different neighborhoods, different ethnics, all like living in the same space. So when I lived in New York for 10 years, I remember going to the streets. I live in the East Village, walking on 2nd Avenue, and then there would be like Latin music, and then 100 meters away, there was punk rock, and a little further, there was hip hop. And then I would get on the subway, and there were bucket drumming, you know, and then you go to Central Park, and you had like disco music. So definitely we wanted to have that. And the film is full of music. And as you know, the Jewel of the Crown is September of Earth, Wind, and Fire, which is the theme of Robot and Dog. And as you said, apart from the songs, we have original score of Alfonso Villalonga. He worked with me in Blancanieves. He worked with me on Abracadabra. We had a great collaboration. So he created this amazing, jazzy, melodic with the leading piano, which we got inspired a little bit by Charlie Brown and Vince Guaraldi. So definitely the combination of sound design, music, pop songs and famous songs, and original score makes that the sound. I could define that Robot Dreams is a musical above all.
Oh, it definitely is. It's a musical at the truest sense of being a musical, in that the music serves as the dialogue. And that's one of the keys of a musical, is that the music, the lyrics, are dialogue.
Completely. I think in a film that it doesn't have dialogue, the music is the voice.
Yeah.
And if we analyze the main theme of the film is September of Earth, Wind, and Fire, as we talked before briefly, it's like in the lyrics is the theme of this film.
Mm-hmm.
The first line is, do you remember? The 21st night of September, do you remember? Memory is one of the main themes of this film, how memory helps you to overcome loss. And 21st night of September, of course I remember, my daughter was born.
It was a sign.
Go further, the 21st of September to the 22nd is when summer moves to autumn.
Yep.
So, come on, in that line, there's a lot of power in that line. So it's just, it's like a musical. It's like the lyrics of a musical, like an opera.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I've got to ask you, then, with all of this, all of your product placement, oh my God, Pablo, was there anything? You've got Fruit Loops, you've got all kinds of milk, you've got candy, you've got all these name brands of all the pop culture zeitgeist marketing.
Yeah.
And of course, I do like the play on Radio Shack with Robot Shack. How did you decide which items of the culture you wanted to include in here? Because I'm trying to think if you missed anything, and I don't think you did.
Well, the thing is that, you know, definitely there's a lot of product. I would love if it was product placement, because normally product placement is an exchange of money.
Yep.
And there was no exchange of money. It was just more like products that I remember, my memories when I lived in the States. And definitely there were so many, like, different things that, you know, I had in my refrigerator, or like stores and brands that they have disappeared. Yeah, definitely my favorite, one of my favorites is Robot Shack. That kind of thing. That's one of my favorite. But of course, there's all this fast food that people used to have in the refrigerator for a picnic. So, yeah, there's so many things. I thought that that gave some reality to the to a film that is like a fable. And I think that combination of fable and reality, and that people can connect, I think to have all those brands, it helped.
Yes, absolutely. And dare I say, your Robot Shack, that, as somebody who used to love going to Radio Shack, going all the way back to the 1960s, you your animators have portrayed Radio Shack of the 80s so beautifully, with the way it's split up, the way the wall displays are done on the pegs. Just fabulous attention to detail at every level, Pablo.
Thank you so much. I love, for me, cinema is about detail. So that's why there are hundreds of people working on a film for so many years. So audience can have a 1.5-hour experience, but there's so many years of work. And filmmakers, we love detail when people like you appreciate them.
As I said, as much as I love Blancanieves, which was a spectacle of beauty, I love Robot Dreams even more. And I hope you make another animated feature.
I'm sure I will. I don't know which is going to be next, but I'm sure I will do another animation. I enjoyed it very much.
Pablo, thank you so, so much. This has been an absolute delight getting to speak with you this morning about Robot Dreams. And I hope we get to talk again in the future.
I'm sure. I can see that you know my work. It was a great pleasure to talk with you, Debbie.
Oh, Pablo, thank you. And you have a wonderful weekend.
Yes, and you keep spreading the word, Debbie. We need you with a megaphone. Screaming, step right in.
I'm so loud, I don't think we need a megaphone. The girls will tell you that. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was the fabulous Pablo Berger. He is one of the sweetest guys out there, and he truly does. He is a filmmaker that loves film, that loves cinema, that loves the history of film. And you can see it with the films he does and how he incorporates cinema's history and its glorious past into the films he makes today, such as with Blancanieves, and he incorporated a lot of Snow White, many of the themes from the book, from the Disney animated film, as a matter of fact, and other iterations. Robot Dreams is just the sequencing, paying homage to the movies, to The Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, Busby Berkeley. You could just lift that entire segment out and create your own music video. Go to the theater. This is a film you really want to see on the big screen. It is so beautiful and rich and textured emotionally, visually, and through music. So please do yourself a favor. Robot Dreams is one. And you can take kids. That's another beautiful thing. And then if you want a real treat, go to Amazon or other booksellers and buy Sarah Varone's kid's book of the same name, Robot Dreams. Now, we're going to switch gears here. And he's back. He's back after a long absence. Hello, Jonathan Smith.
Hi, Debbie. How are you? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I was going to say, should we be doing our own Verizon commercial?
Yes, I think so. That's a blast from the past.
I know. It's so good to have you joining me again on the show.
Yes, I'm so excited, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my God. Well, you don't need an invitation from me. It's, you know.
Oh, okay. Well, then I'll do every week, then. I'll promote myself every week.
Hey, please, feel free. Feel free.
Terrific.
You know, I have been waiting and waiting to see what you would do after Batshit Bride. And
Oh, okay.
Lo and behold, you give me something I like even better than Batshit Bride. And you know how much I liked Batshit Bride.
Yes, thank you. Yes. You're very generous in your praise, and I really appreciated it then and I appreciate it now, and I'm so glad that you like this one even better.
Well, and what I also like seeing even better is I see your growth as a filmmaker.
Oh, thank you. And it's not backwards growth. I hope
no, no. This is forward. Moving forward.
Good.
I see your growth as a filmmaker. And that's the thing that really tickles me when filmmakers like you, when I have you on the show or I see your first work and then I follow you and your subsequent works and I can see a steady progression where you're not languishing or you're not going backwards, where you actually, the lessons that you learn with each film that you do or each new tool in the filmmaker's toolbox, you put it to use and you do it judiciously and appropriately. And
thank you.
You have done that here with Guy Friends. And you're wearing so many hats, as usual. Writer, director, cinematographer, editor, and you did some sound mixing too.
Yes, although I will say this time, not just for lack of resources or my control freakishness, the pandemic also forced me to do a little bit of that too, because this was a pandemic film and I did everything I could to reduce the amount of crew and reduce the amount of actors as possible. I don't think you notice it when you, nobody's ever said it to me after watching the film, but the draft of the script that I wrote was after writing some pre-pandemic, you know, in a world where I didn't even imagine a pandemic of like a mid-budget version of the film. After the pandemic started, I wrote a new draft. It was kind of like, I would say like there are three major iterations of the script. And the pandemic version was the one where I cut down all the scenes as much as possible to be as few actors as possible and as much of it outdoors as possible without looking unnatural. And if it was indoors, you know, hopefully just two or maybe three actors and as little crew as possible.
Well, you know, one of the great things about watching this, as I'm watching Guy Friends, I kept thinking, God, this would work so well on the stage.
Yes, I agree with you. I feel like for a fleeting moment, I thought that too. After finishing it, or maybe while editing it, I hadn't thought that thought in a while, but yes, I think you're right. It could work.
I mean, as I'm watching, and it's because of the efficiency that you have and the fact that we really are honing in. This is a great story. We've got Jamie Sharma, who is our heroine, our protagonist, and She is just upbeat, overly cheery to everyone around her. She is their rah-rah cheerleader from the guy next door to the doorman, to the Uber driver, to the barista, to the security guy in the office building, to even her boss. She is like there. She's Miss Positivity. She's got a jerk for a boyfriend, though.
Yes. Yeah, you know, a small, quick thing I'll share about that. He's the villain for all intents and purposes. Not that there's like, it's not like a dastardly, villainous role or anything like that. It's not kind of film for one, but he is the villain. And I wrote him, you know, obviously to be a jerk, but I didn't realize until, reading some reviews recently and then also watching the film with a large audience, which I hadn't done for a long time, where I was like, man, that guy's really hateable. I didn't realize how hateable he was.
He truly is. He really is. But, you know, after she takes a break, you know, is this a Ross Rachel kind of break or is this a total breakup? We kind of, there's some ambiguity there. In her mind, it's just a Ross Rachel kind of friends break. Obviously in Patrick's mind, it's a breakup, but then,
he's just too cowardly to end it.
So then as so many of us have done over the decades in a drunken stupor at night, when your heart is broken, you're miserable. Maybe your heart's not broken, but you're just miserable. You post something on social media that you will live to regret because the next day her whole life changes. And everybody, all of these people that she's been their cheerleader for, they've all been great guy friends. Then all of a sudden, oh, I saw your post. Well, now that Patrick's gone, I love you. Oh, I saw your post. Now that Patrick's gone, I love you. And and then she's got to rethink her existence, essentially. It's like, what have I done? What have I done? And you solve that problem for us by adding a new dynamic with Jamie's friend, Ted, who doesn't care, but didn't see her post, doesn't care about her post. And yeah, he loves her as a friend, but no, he doesn't love her. But his girlfriend slash fiance, Sandy, is the one who adds a different dynamic and really turns things around in the story and with Jamie. And the way you introduce Sandy, and then the lessons and the dialogue that you have incorporated, it's just fantastic. And
oh, thank you.
You know, and I have to say that it's like, I do not have many female friends because most of them are whiny, clawing, and a pain in the ass. You know, most my closest friends, with the exception of one or two women, are all guys. I can talk about cars with them. I can talk about construction with them. You know, it's, and there's no issue. Just like Jamie had no issue. She could talk to any of these guys about anything. Just casual, no nonsense conversations. But then the minute something happens, you know, luckily, I've never been in Jamie's position with that happening to me. So I have maintained my autonomy, maybe. This is going to be so relatable for so many women out there. And if you put the shoe on the other foot for guys out there, too, whose besties are all women.
Yes. So it's funny that you mentioned, well, two things about that. One, I do find that whenever people watch the film, I guess particularly women, they usually, and this I consider a good thing, they feel impelled to detail, like, am I like a Jamie or am I not like a Jamie? I've spoken to some women who are like, actually, I don't have any guy friends. And then others who I'm like, I'm totally like that. So it's funny to see, like, the levels of relatability. I do agree, though, that I get a ton of female viewers who watch the film and they're like, oh my gosh, I get it. You know, like I have experienced that before. And I'm also glad to hear that you think that the males can, that men can relate, because I, my original enjoyment, and this is an interesting tidbit of the evolution of the script, which I'll go ahead and share. My original enjoyment of the film, my own personal amusement in writing it was, and this is what I did in the first draft primarily, was to mock myself and to mock my own courtship habits that I'd certainly, you know, done in the past. I like to think I'm a little bit more mature than some of those habits now, only a little bit. But that was my original enjoyment, was just mocking myself through the guy friends, and it was a great time. But the first draft, I think, you know, I don't remember it that well. It was a little while ago. What I do remember is that all the guy friend stuff, from first draft to last draft, really did not change in substance or even in structure, except that they were backgrounded a little bit more in later drafts, which was purposeful. I wanted them to decrease in visibility as Jamie more and more befriended Sandy. But after my first writing group where I workshopped the script, we read it. Everybody thought it was really funny. And then two young ladies in my writing group kind of tag team simultaneously said, because I think in that first draft, Jamie, like, ultimately found love with some other guy, and, like, the usual cliche trope of just, like, oh, a guy, maybe it was even Ted, I can't remember. But they suggested, what if this were actually a story about Jamie befriending her first female friend? And, like, I snapped my fingers, and I said, that's the direction it needs to go, that's the best direction for the story. So I went in that direction for the film. So that's actually the full, like, three iterations of the draft. There was the first draft, mocking myself mostly, and then the next draft and subsequent drafts, which were the female friendships focus, going in that direction. And then the once the pandemic happened, me writing it for a pandemic budget and pandemic shooting resources and safety.
Now, I mean, I just love the structure, and I love all the various characters, you know, as we go through Ted, Patrick, Mr. Vanderbilt, Terrence, who we never see, we just hear on the phone.
Yes, yes. That's the and I always forget. I literally always forget until people remind me. I play Terrence, and I have traveled across the country to go on a date before. So I was like, well, who better to play it? And also, I mean, I perform. I'm an improv comedian, but I'm not an actor or anything. I don't care. I don't go for roles or anything like that. But I was like, well, who better to play this than me, who has done that before? And also, I don't have to be on screen. Which I prefer. I can just do a voice role. So I did Terrence.
And I, you know, it's the minute I heard the phone and Terrence, it's like, I'm thinking, is that Jonathan? So.
Yep. It was me. I mean, you have heard my voice. So you were, yes. you were primed at least maybe to recognize it if you remembered.
Well, you actually did a really great job with the voicing of Terrence with all of his phone calls. As we get into. Okay, I've made a reservation. I'm coming into town. You're in California. I'm coming into town. I made the reservation. Oh, my God, you've got to be there. And your desperation, your exuberant desperation, that is what you infused into Terrence. And
it was probably what it was in real life, too.
And then countering that, is I've got to tell you, I don't know where you found Kavita Jarawala, who plays Jamie. I can't believe she had never acted before. She is amazing. She's wonderful.
Oh, terrific. I'm glad to hear that. I can tell you exactly where I found her. She's my brother's girlfriend, now fiance. And when I was casting Jamie, we were all home for the holidays. And I'd met Kavita. I'd not spent a lot of time with her, but like while hanging out with her at my parents' house while I'm casting, while I'm trying to find somebody to play Jamie, who the other thing that's, that, and this isn't just like, you know, some lecherous, lascivious director or whatever wanting to work with beautiful people. Like that was written, that was like part of the reason, like that was a characteristic of the role that I needed. Like she needed to be objectively beautiful. Which is just part of the reason why every male in this film, in this world, you know, is another reason why, you know, he's in love with her. And I mean, Kavita is objectively beautiful. And when I was at home, kind of like hanging out with her, for just like some moment, like maybe in the television room or whatever, it's like, I wonder if she can act. She might be kind of good for this. So I actually asked my brother first. That's not to be like paternalistic or anything. It was more just like, hey, you know, like I might, you know, if I give her the role and she likes it, you know, I would hate to be the person who, you know, I don't know if the actor's life is always the best life for most people. It's a really tough life. And she was on a great path, and she is, you know, she's a nurse. She's doing great. It's a good career. And so I asked my brother first, like, would you mind if I maybe ask Kavita if she wants to audition for this role? He's like, no, that's fine. So I asked her, and she auditioned. She was very good in the audition. Like, she just taped something. And then she was even better on set. She did things naturally in front of the camera between action and take that other actors take years to learn, and she would just snap into it like, you know, she's like a fish to water.
Yeah, I love her facial expressiveness and even her body language. When Jamie is dejected, when she's depressed, we see that on her face.
Yeah.
She hangs her head down, you know, looks down at the ground instead of straight ahead. The bounce is gone from her step. It's really, I love the emotional layers that she brings. I mean, it's great, and what makes it even greater is the fact that this was her very first acting role. She never acted before.
I know it's really incredible. I'll also share this, and I want to commend. Well, they both were fantastic actors in the film too. Justin Clark, who played Ted, and then of course Katie Muldowney, who plays Sandy, the other lead character in the film. They are both graduates of the Actors Studio together. I think they're in the same. Yeah, they're in the same class. So. You know, like I rehearsed with all three of them over Zoom. Again, it was pandemic, and also some of us were not in the same area. I rehearsed with them over Zoom, but I'm pretty sure that Ted and Sandy also worked with Kavita before. I'm sorry, Justin and Katie also worked with Kavita a fair amount over Zoom too, and probably gave her some pointers and tricks, and honestly, probably a free crash course and everything that they learned. A little bit more expensively at the Actors Studio.
Well, you know, Katie Muldowney is Sandy. She is funny. She is funny.
Great.
And she, as if we don't have enough humor coming out of the inherent situation that we have. That's one of the great things that you have done here, Jonathan, and you did this in Batshit Bride. You do it here. The comedy comes from the situation. It's situational comedy. And it really shines.
Thank you.
Then when you get some talents who can just take it the next step, you know, it just makes it that much more enjoyable. You know, all of the all of the performances are, you know, they're top notch. Your structure is great. The dialogue is great. It's very naturalistic. Nothing feels forced. I really love it. And then you go and you make and you shoot this black and white, which I love. I love.
Okay.
Because with a film like this, it's black and white with the shades of gray that really metaphorically speaks to Jamie's world. And the different shades of gray that come with it.
Yeah, so that choice, I mean, I'll go ahead and detail that choice.
Yes, please.
You know, might be interesting to some of your listeners who are filmmakers. You know, I originally wrote the script to be a mid-budget comedy in color, no different from, you know, any other, I don't know, like a Devil Wears Prada or something like that.
Sure.
And then, the pandemic, I was forced to rethink the film. At first, I just kind of shelved it. And then, like, a few months into the pandemic, I was like, well, you know, I wonder, it kind of flashed in my head, like, maybe there's a smaller, like, at least seemingly artsier way. I actually don't know if the film is artsy necessarily, but seemingly artsier way to do it. And this black and white version of it flashed in my head. And also, we should note that there are some scenes in color, interstitial, excuse me, interview scenes that are in color, which is important, you know, hopefully once, you know, you reach the end, you understand the reason why it's done that way. But the black and white choice is, I don't want to spoil that ending too much, but one, you know, obviously there are plenty of homages to Manhattan from, what was that, 1979? Mm-hmm. And I love Gordon Willis's photography in that. And I mean, obviously, frankly, there was a part of me that wanted to ape it. But also there's a practical reason, which is, you know, I was my own cinematographer and working with few resources, few lights. I mean, I shot the whole thing with two softbox lights, natural lighting that I could find, and a reflector when I was outside. And that was it. And in black and white, you know, dark areas in a screen can look really wonderful and rich and sumptuous. I mean, like, watch any of Gordon Willis's work, and you'll notice, like, how well he uses darks in parts of the screen. It's just fabulous. So I did that. And that was a practical choice. Another part of the practical choice was I actually was really glad. It was one of my own personal proudest achievements with Batshit Bride was actually achieve something of a color scheme that I had intended, which is hard to do, especially with independent filmmaking, where sometimes you can just shoot in the locations that you can get and that's it. But with black and white, I was like, well, my color scheme's pretty easy. Everything reduces to grayscale anyway.
Yep.
So, you know, I can shoot something with this, you know, kind of like, I don't know, yellow is actually my favorite color, but not so much on screen. Like putrid, pale yellow color or whatever. And it just reduces the grayscale anyway, so it doesn't matter. So I actually shot the whole thing for, it was a different experience. I was shooting the whole thing for light and shadow rather than any sort of color scheme. And also for composition, of course. But then the final thing is, and it's the most important reason, is the artistic thing, where all I'll say is the interviews are of women who are fully friends. That's the world of female friendship. And then there's the black and white that most of the film is in. And then in the end, you know, there's the final moment. And hopefully everything I just said makes sense.
Oh, don't give anything away at the end.
I know. Well, I don't think I said exactly what happens. But
no.
But I primed people to appreciate it, I guess.
Now, you know, as I said, I love the black and white. And I love the metaphor that comes with it. And I'm a huge proponent of shades of gray and how that can be used to really help shape a story, tell a story. Quite often better than color. It's
I wouldn't disagree with you. I agree sometimes. Yeah, absolutely. There are some films where it's like when they're in black and white, it's like that's the best way to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, I thought that was just so fabulous that you went that route. Now, because you're also the editor here, let's throw in hat number four, or maybe five, since you're also a producer. Let's throw in the next hat of editor. Mm-hmm. What was your editing process on this one? Were you editing as you went because of shooting during COVID, because of the way you were shooting? Did you wait till you had all of the footage and then start assembling it? What was your editing process?
Yeah, so I did not edit while we were filming. Actually, even though it was a pandemic film, we still did shoot the film, like a bulk of it within like 3 weeks overall. I shot it for, I think, a month and a half. Like, you know, we slowed down. There's a certain amount of time that Katie was available. So that was like the bulk of the shooting. But then some scenes trickled off near the end. So I think it was about a month and a half total. I did not edit. But one funny small story I'll share is, like, I don't know, midway or maybe two-thirds of the way through filming, I would go home every night and I would, back up footage and save it to my Google Drive. Then at one point I noticed like some little like red dots in the footage. And I was like, what the heck is that? Is that a problem with my lens? I later learned that it was dead pixels, which was something that we had to fix. The camera that I had, I guess, had dead pixels in the sensor. And nobody notices because my colorist, and actually there is a lot. My colorist worked so hard on this film. You can't imagine how much work there actually is in black and white. Yeah. But we fixed that later with dead pixel filters. But I didn't start editing until after the film. And I'm a little bit of a psychotic editor. I'm really fastidious. I like to say I use every piece of the buffalo. And by that, I mean, when I edit a scene, first I'll edit the first cut of a scene. And then once I, you know, like the first cut, I do plenty in sustained masters. So that will just be, you know, finding the take that I like best. But, if it's shot counter shot or some other shot scheme, I go and I edit the first cut, and I watch, I'm like, yeah, this is good. I generally like these camera choices here and there. And then I go through and I look through the rest of the visual takes. Maybe I, you know, use a different, maybe I'm like, oh, actually the acting's better from this shot. And I like that shot anyway. So let me sub that out. Let me cut this in and remove what I originally had there. But then once I've gone through all of the image, all of the, takes, I throw away the images and then I keep the sound and I go through all the sound and I see if any line deliveries dub in better. And mm-hmm. I like those deliveries better. So a lot of the scene, every time I watch a scene or every time I edit a scene, I would say like probably every scene in every film I do, certainly since my second film, includes just natural dubs where I pulled lines from other takes mm-hmm. and dubbed them in, and they work just fine and you never notice, and they're an even better line delivery. And that would sound a little bit crazy, like, oh, you don't need to waste your time doing that. But then I will go back and watch the first cut of a scene and then watch the final cut where I even dubbed in lines, Frankenstein it all together. And it's, for me, it's a notable difference. Like, I'm like, that was worth the extra time. And sometimes you're literally looking at somebody's like mouth, speaking. I mean, it's true in Guy Friends. Like literally we didn't dub the line afterwards. I just took a delivery from before and it dubbed in just fine. And you might be looking right at the person's mouth and not even notice. So that's pretty much my editing process for scenes. And then I put it all together. And I usually go to, again, my writing group that I mentioned before. I go to mm-hmm. them and they comment on the whole thing. And after that, I'm really pretty ruthless, like shaving the film down. I have no trouble cutting things out. I don't miss things after I cut them out. If it's a good cut, I don't care that it's gone. And certainly in Guy Friends, I cut out, you know, I cut a couple scenes in half. I don't think I really reordered scenes at all. Mm-hmm. I did that a lot in my second film, but it was a nonlinear film, so I could reorder all I wanted. This one's linear. So, yeah. But I definitely did go in and cut out. I certainly cut a couple scenes in half, and I cut out, a few moments, a few dumb jokes, and I think I cut one scene entirely. It was a dummy scene anyway. So that's it.
Now explain this to me. You do stand-up comedy, but you wrote dumb jokes.
Yeah. Well, I have done stand-up comedy. I'm more of an improvisational comedian, and I used to do a fair amount of sketch, but I don't do it anymore. I still do improv, I still write dumb jokes.
Jonathan.
And I know. At the very least, sometimes jokes, I call them tone jumpers, as in like, that just doesn't really fit the tone of the mm-hmm. scene or even the tone of the whole movie. I thought it, you know, like maybe I thought it was funny at the time, and maybe it was even funny on set, but once I, you know, edit the scene, I'm like, the tone of the scene, it just doesn't really work, so I cut it out.
Oh, my gosh. So now,
yeah, I know.
You've just burst my bubble. You've burst my bubble of your exemplary talent. Darn. Well,
yeah.
After going through your editing process, at what point does your score come in? Because I have to tell you, the music, I love the music. You've got this great jazzy vibe happening. We've got some nice, you know, some drums, some soft brush on the drums in the background, piano, really nice jazzy vibe. Talk to me about when your music came into play and what you were looking for from your composer.
Yes, thank you. Because I'm so glad that I'm so glad when people mention the composer. Her name is Emmy Nishida, and she's a fantastic composer. I had never worked with her before. I won't name the person. He wouldn't care if I did. I do write with a partner. I write stuff on my own, and then I also write with a partner. Nothing that we've produced yet, but hopefully one thing that we wrote is my next film. Mm-hmm. Her husband is a wonderful pianist, and he's great. And I approached him first to do the music, but it just didn't work out. Too busy, or I think it might have been too busy or whatever. So I was looking for referrals. I asked the Bashit Bride composer, but I wanted jazz, and he just straightforward said, like, oh, jazz is not my milieu. I don't really know it at all. So I needed to look for somebody else. And a buddy of mine, actually the guy who plays the security guard in Guy Friends, he's a longtime buddy of mine. We used to work at an animation company together, but we're also filmmaking buddies. And he referred me to his composer, who was Emmy. And I, you know, emailed with her. I can't remember. Maybe I Zoomed with her. I obviously watched some of her videos and listened to some of her samples. And, I mean, she's just a fantastic musical talent. She absolutely knows jazz. And so we worked together. Now, not only is she fantastically musically talented, the other thing that's fantastic about her is, like, you know, I guess you could call it her executive function. She is so, like, she is such a workhorse, and she is so organized and so on top of everything, which, you know, no offense, musicians, not all musicians are like that. And she is, it's incredible. Like, she has both the musical talent and the business talent. And she, like, I can't remember if I gave her any references or anything. I'm not sure. Maybe I said, like, go watch a Woody Allen film from, like, the 1970s or something like that. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. But I mean, she nailed it, and working with her was fantastic. She would send me samples of pieces. I pinpointed the places. Okay, so you asked me about when it happened. Once I had a first cut of the whole film, then I was like, all right, Emmy, let's start to work. And I would send her sequences, and I would say, I want music here, 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 and here. And she would send me samples for the moments, and often she would, you know, like, a sample for, you know, a certain segment where I wanted music would be great. I'd be like, great, expand that and do this whole sequence from this point to that point. And then sometimes she'd send something where I'm like, this is a wonderful piece of music, but let's actually use it over on this scene instead. So that happened sometimes. I don't know if I'll say equally, but it happened plenty where, like, you know, yeah, she'd send me something and I'd be like, that's a fantastic idea for this interstitial interview. Or, you know what, take this little piece here and do that for the whole finale, the whole third act, because that's a pretty long piece. And then even sometimes, you know, I'm a musician myself, so sometimes I would even say, like, I remember the Statue of Liberty musical piece, that little day trip to the Statue of Liberty. I said, oh, this is a great piece, but literally just take this part and do that first, and take this first part and do it second. And then it worked out great. So yeah, that's how we worked. And I mean, she's just, she's incredible. She's a fantastic musical talent and a great pianist too. And she did it all digitally. So these drums and everything, I don't know how it works, but she did it all with her computer magic, music magic.
I love the score. I love the score of this.
Anybody who's listening, you can go listen to it on Spotify. Just look up Guy Friend's soundtrack. You probably find it.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, this is the kind of soundtrack that reminds me of, you know, the evening cocktail parties people would have in the neighborhood would get together and have in their home in the 1960s, in the late 50s and 60s. And that music would be the ambient music on the hi-fi, on the stereo.
Mm-hmm.
I just love it. The martini music, I like to call it.
that's great.
But no, it's really wonderful. The whole package here, Jonathan, is so well done. Having made a quote unquote COVID film, mm-hmm. and you've come through so successfully, you know, what did you, and you know, since Batshit Bride, I mean, this is now your fourth film that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn as a filmmaker about yourself making this one, making Guy Friends, that will buoy you, buttress you, or that you can take into the future with upcoming films?
Wow. Gosh, that's a very good question that I'm not entirely prepared for. I don't want to be like negative in some of my lessons, but I guess I will be. I don't want to produce anymore while directing. It's too much work. It is so much work. But it also, like, the another reason I don't like it, or at least like certainly like line producing, which, you know, like, I'm a producer just broadly speaking, but a lot of it is kind of like line producing when I'm on set. And I also feel like I'm like shortchanging the actors when I do that. I mean, I remember on my second film, there was one day where I even like apologized to the actors. I was like, I'm sorry, I was a producer today, not a director. It worked out fine, but even still, I had to say that. The other thing is, I know that I love directing, but it's been very difficult on my last few films because of the producerial thing. So I really want to, the next one I make, I really only want to be like a creative producer and somebody else doing like more of the line producery things, all the stress on set, so that I can remember that I love directing. So those are a couple of things I learned. I mean, certainly like little bits and bobs there are some, I could go into specific examples. There are some scenes where, you know, like I'm dissatisfied with the lighting. And you know, I always learn like little things where it's like, you know, if you don't fix this now, you're not really going to be able to fix it in post. And I could enumerate some of those, but I don't know if I maybe bore some of your listeners. Insofar as my own, maybe this is the way that some of your listeners would like to hear, I do think that I've improved a lot at the I always hate to be mystical about films, but I'll just go ahead and say like emotional through line of a film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very practical filmmaker. I'm a very practical storyteller. I only like to speak about it in practical terms because I think it's a pretty practical art form. But nonetheless, I maybe somewhat jokingly, but it's also kind of seriously, like to reduce films to they're all really the same story, and it goes like this. Our hero protagonist is going about life with a routine or a plan, and everything's going to plan until the inciting incident happens, and then flips the protagonist's life completely upside down. And then, you know, the protagonist liked life beforehand, or at least was, you know, comfortable in it. And so the end of Act One is the protagonist deciding, I'm going to try to return things to the way that they were before the inciting incident. That's all, that's every first act. Now the inciting incident was, you know, narratively, and I guess we can say cosmically designed to be the perfect test of whatever that protagonist's flaw is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the end of Act One is, I'm going to try to return life before, I'm going to try to return to my life before the inciting incident. And Act 2A, the first half of the second act, is the protagonist trying to do that without addressing his flaw. And then at the midpoint, the protagonist realizes, actually, if I'm going to do this, I might need to address my flaw. And then Act 2B is trying to return life to normal while actually, like, you know, leaning into and addressing the flaw. And then at the end of Act 2, everything falls apart and the protagonist falls back on his flaw. But then the third act is overcoming that disappointing moment at the end of Act 2. And, you know, maybe, you know, this is where you can go into, like, whether it's a tragedy or comedy or somewhere in mm-hmm. between. But let's just say for happy ending, overcoming the flaw and returning life probably to a new normal, but overcoming the flaw. A perfect example is Jaws, because Jaws is always a perfect example. Chief Brody, afraid of the water, living on an island, ironically, I guess. A giant shark comes in, starts terrorizing his town. He's the one who's responsible for fixing it. And of course, a giant shark coming into his town is a perfect test of his flaw of being afraid of the water. So at the end of Act 1, he decides, I'm going to try to rid myself of this shark without addressing my fear of the water. And if you notice, like, he will only go up to, like, the shoreline in Act 2A. He never goes near the water. He never goes into the water. He's trying to fix it without addressing his fear of the water. But then at the midpoint, the shark nearly eats his son, and he realizes, oh, you know what? If I'm going to kill this shark, I need to go address my flaw. So he goes out on a boat and starts to lean into his fear of the water. And then at the end of Act 2, the boat's sinking and all that stuff, but then they overcome it and they defeat the shark in the end. And when he defeats the shark, he also defeats his fear of the water. He overcomes his flaw, and that's why the last shot of the film is him swimming back to shore. It's the first time we've seen him swimming. And that's every story ever told. Character has a flaw, and character, you know, inciting incident, turns life of the character upside down. Character tries to return life to normal or a new normal while overcoming or not overcoming his flaw. That's every story ever told on film. And I feel like all of this is to answer your question. I understand how to achieve that even a little bit better with Guy Friends. And I know that it's shown in the scripts that I'm working on now. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, this makes sense. And I'm able to, like, you know, find the right story to do that, to fulfill that, even a little bit more quickly than I could on Guy Friends and before that on Battleship Ride and before that on my second film and my first film. So that's maybe the biggest lesson that I'm continuing to hone.
Now, do you think that you will do another film that is predominantly black and white?
Oh, not next. You know, what's funny is I realized, like, you know what? I didn't realize it, but I always wanted to do at least one black and white film in my career. And I did that.
And look at that. You have.
Yeah. And now I did it and it's under my belt. I don't, like, you know, if another film comes along and I think that black and white would be good for it, then I totally will. But I'll just say I'm not going to do it arbitrarily just for the sake of black and white.
Oh,
I'll do
no.
It because, yeah. I'll do it because I think that there's a narrative. Oh, and I know that you weren't implying that. I'll do it if I write something and I'm like, you know what, this would really work in black and white and would help the story. It would make total sense for the story, which I felt it did here. And I can totally picture myself writing something where maybe that's the case again.
Yeah. There are some stories, some scripts that you can't, black and white just will not work. It will not translate. For an audience,
actually, what I will,
or for the story.
Yeah. Actually, what I will say, this isn't your question, but I do think it's a fine jumping off point or jumping off answer. What I would really like to do, and this would maybe be good in black and white, it would be a lot like Manhattan again. I really want to find a film where shooting it in widescreen 2.35 or 2.4 to 1, I would really, really like to do that. But I haven't. Yeah, I mean, like, comedies don't often shoot that way.
No.
They don't often shoot in that aspect ratio. They have, but they're usually in the aspect ratio. They're usually in a flat aspect ratio that I've used so far. But I'd love to find, like, a story that would be great for widescreen.
I have no doubt that one day you will.
Oh, thank you.
I have no doubt. So, now, everybody, there is no excuse not to see Guy Friends because it hit theaters May 31st, select theaters, but it is on, I think, every streaming platform known to mankind. DirecTV,
well, yes.
Dish, Sling, Amazon, Apple, Google Play, YouTube Movies, and it's on DVD. That came out June 4th.
Can I actually, for your listeners, can I specify a little bit? Because this was one of the frustrations of the opening day release was, yes, everything that you just said is where it is or will be. On opening day, I learned that actually, like, some of these platforms have been delayed for processing reasons. I don't understand. I think, like, Amazon's, like, really behind on processing. So a lot of films. So I do know, like, the film will be available to stream on Amazon at some point soon. And you can already buy it on DVD on Amazon. But I do know, if any of your listeners out there want to go watch this film immediately, I do know, like, to just stream it, rent or buy. Currently, the best places are Apple TV, YouTube Movies, Google Play, Xbox, Hoopla, and Spectrum. Those places I know are sure bets. Apple TV seems to be where most people are probably watching it right now, or go rent it on YouTube Movies. I think maybe, like, if you look for it on YouTube Movies, and, like, YouTube is still, there's search engine optimization. I don't understand the sort of stuff. It's still, you know, ironing itself out. So you might have to change your filter to movies when you look for it. But it's out there. Apple TV is always pretty easy to find now.
Well, yeah, on Apple TV, you're in very good company with the product that Apple TV has been putting out. Especially the past 8-9 months. I mean, with Masters of the Air, Manhunt, Palm Royale. I mean, these are outstanding, award-worthy series that they're popping out. Just so you're in very good company on Apple TV.
Oh, thank you. Nobody's ever accused me of being prestige, so I readily accept your accusation. if I fool anyone into thinking I'm prestige, then, well, I'm grateful and it would be a first.
Well, I think that on Apple TV, I think you're in very good company. So, and, you know, they have run a little behind Netflix. Netflix has just given us gluts of, I won't say the word, but it also starts with a G. But Apple, they're like the tortoise in the tortoise and the hare. They were slow and steady. Mm-hmm. And when they hit, they have just given us one fantastic thing after another. Including Monarch, Legacy of Monsters. Hello. The Kurt Russell, Wyatt Russell series.
Yeah.
I mean, so you're in very good company on Apple.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, Jonathan, this has been so much fun having you back on the show, talking about Friends.
I'm glad that I could do it again, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my God. The minute I got the first the press blast in April, I didn't even read the press blast. I just saw it was you. And I emailed Annie and I said, I want Jonathan. Here's what I got. So you've been, you know, long time. I mean, you've been booked in this slot since, you know, like the first week of May, end of April.
Yes.
So I'm just so tickled beyond belief. And, of course, this show, you know, I'll have it archived and up on my website and all the usual podcast places later on, either late tonight or tomorrow morning. And your wonderful trailer will also be in there so people can see
the
trailer. Yeah. Yeah. When I do interviews, I always, if they're standalone interviews, when they go up on the website, I always include the trailer at the bottom of whatever I'm writing about. As a companion to the interview, and same thing with every show. So the trailer will be up there too, along with where you can screen this film. Oh, will this be opening? Will Guy Friends be opening in more theaters than these select few?
No, the theater run is done.
Okay.
So anybody who wants to watch it, just, you know, go to the streaming. You know what I'll do afterwards? Listeners, I hope you enjoy our planning over this interview. I'll email you afterwards, Debbie, with the link so that listeners, you can find them.
Oh, terrific. And then I'll just plug them in on the website.
Fantastic.
For today's show.
Perfect.
Jonathan, hurry up and make another film. You have to come back.
Thank you. Well, listeners, anybody out there who's rich, hurry up and please fund an independent film, specifically my next one, and I'll go make it for you.
Yes, and they can find out more. Give me the website, your website, the Vile Henchman site, so people can find you.
Oh, yes. Website is farther behind the social media, but vilehenchman.com or at vilehenchman on pretty much Instagram and Twitter. It's Twitter. Not X, it's Twitter. And Vile Henchman is spelled VileHenchmen. So henchman is plural. So Vile Henchman.
Well, we could say you're also a vile henchman, but we won't do that.
No, I'm not. I'm moderately unsettling henchman in real life.
Oh, Jonathan. Yeah. Thank you so much. And you know, you don't have to wait to come back on the show. Whenever you've got something popping up, just email me. Since Jonathan is one of those filmmakers that actually has my direct email. Just email me. And
okay, thanks. Maybe next time, like, Chad Miller and I can come on and tag team.
Oh, my God. I haven't talked to
Chad. Wouldn't that be fun?
I haven't talked to Mr. Chad Verb in a while. I got to get in touch with him. I thought of him with guy friends. I'm like, wait a minute, Chad's not in it. Chad should be in it.
I don't know what I was thinking.
Oh, well, I'll forgive you this time.
Sorry, Chad.
I'll forgive you this time. I don't know if Chad will, but I'll forgive you this time.
Okay, thank you.
Jonathan, have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your day. Hopefully we will chat sooner rather than later. I'll look for the email and I'll get all this up and out, and we can plaster the world with guy friends.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Debbie.
Thanks, Jonathan. Bye-bye.
So long.
And that was producer, writer, director, cinematographer, editor, sound mixer, Jonathan Smith. And as I've said before, one of the great things about Jonathan is he's not somebody that is just doing all of these jobs in the course of making a film just to do them or out of ego. He truly does understand each of these processes, and is actually, he's skilled at them. And that makes all the difference in the world, as opposed to somebody it's like, well, I'm just going to do everything. But they know nothing. No, Jonathan truly does. But I can't wait to see what he does next. But Guy Friends, it's out there. It's streaming. As he said, theatrical run is over. You know, find it. Start with Apple TV. You won't be disappointed. And quickly, before I sign off here, another film that just came out on Friday. In the United States, in North America, actually, I think it's in Canada as well. Bren Foster, all of you Last Ship fans out there, yeah, you know Bren Wolf himself. Bren has written, directed, and stars in Life After Fighting. It is his first directorial. It is amazing. It deals with, it's very substantive in its story. There's plenty of martial arts, beginning to end. There is plenty of martial arts. And Bren did all of the fight choreography, obviously. He is world champion in one form of the martial arts. I can't remember which one. But it deals with child trafficking. So it's got a lot of gravitas to it, great drama. He truly, truly has done a wonderful job with the film, but it is streaming. It is on VOD. It's on Spectrum, as a matter of fact. I do, yes, that's where I watched it, but, Yeah, it's been in Australia. It's been in some other, in the UK, I think. But it just opened on Friday, just released Friday here in North America and the United States. Check it out. All you Last Ship fans, you will love seeing Brent in action again. Trust me on this one. So he's a dear, dear, dear man. And he takes every craft, everything he tackles so seriously and does so well. I still want to see Brent and Scott Adkins in a movie together, though. Martial arts on martial arts. That is my dream film. So that is all the time we have today. Yes, we ran over, of course. Next week, it's going to be a full house. We've got a husband and wife team. They each have a film in Dances with Films, but they're going to be joining us together. And then we've got the filmmaker of Tim Travers and the Time Traveler's Paradox. So Stimson Sneed will be joining us to talk about that film. And it's all about really bad life choices and hilarity. So you know that's right up my alley. So next week, get ready. We got a lot of live callers, a lot of live filmmakers next week. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.